Our speaker for this morning is Brother Russ Martin, and it's my privilege to turn the meeting over to him. His subject is A River of Water of Life. A River of Water of Life. Brother Russ.
Thank you, Brother Tom. And Brother Mark, maybe you better bring the lights back up. This is kind of a... Yeah, even the front set. Yeah, it'll be bright enough. The screen will be bright enough. This is kind of a half PowerPoint talk. I thought there'd be a few maps and a few other things of interest that would be up there, but there won't be the scriptures in that, so you may want to use your Bibles for that. And we won't have any slides up most of the time. But as you recognize, our title comes from Revelation 22, 1 and 2. And he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb, in the middle of the street. And on the other side of the river was the tree of life, bearing 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. And the leaves of the trees were for the healing of the nations. While preparing for an assignment at this year's General Convention, and it was titled The Decade in Review, we came across some special promises to man concerning some of the topological oddities in the nation of Israel. And we thought we'd like to share some of those with you. The River of Water of Life, a picture we all recognize from the establishment of the millennial age and God's kingdom. Much of what we covered at that review of the decade were signs we have seen in the past few years, 10 specifically, of how God's prophecies concerned Israel, Christendom, and the world of mankind in general. These are pointing to an ever-shortening time until the kingdom is indeed here. No matter how discouraging the multiplying effect is upon our minds of seeing these signs and seeing the disintegration of society, no matter how hard that might be, it is more than offset by the promises we have of those blessings that will ultimately come to the world of mankind in the kingdom and actually are symbolized here. You know, if Jerusalem in its natural state represented the seat of the government of natural Israel, then it must be clear that the new Jerusalem here spoken of earlier in this passage in Revelation 21, actually the preceding chapter 21, verses 1 and 2, that would symbolize thus the spiritual head of the government during the next stage and forever. It will have as its center of authority the divine law and divine power. Every feature of the government will be in accordance and subservient to divine will. Thus, from it and from the throne of God, here in chapter 22 of Revelation, from there will proceed the river of the water of life, of crystalline purity, not clouded with the muddy traditions of men and with the false doctrines of Christendom. No impurity of any kind will be in it. It will be a pure message of the Lord going forth from the millennial kingdom for the blessing, for the refreshment, for the rejuvenation, and for the eternal life of the entire world of mankind. In the natural realm, totally pure water is actually pretty rare, although water covers over 2/3 of our planet and makes up just an absolute essential portion of any kind of life. When we talk about water in its pure sense, any single molecule in the water we're talking about that is not H2O would thus be considered a contaminant and nullifying the purity of that body. The scriptural picture, though, is not really focused on singular molecules of impurity, but instead the contamination of salts. Salts are just a natural part of the earth formed all over. And actually there are multiple types of salts. They're all compounds involving chlorine. The distinguishing substances differentiating fresh water from seawater is actually, I think, what's pictured most in this reference here. It's better to refer to it as salt water, though, because there actually are some seas who have areas of relatively fresh water, and there are some inland lakes that, rather than being fresh, are salty. The scripture that really focuses us on this is found in Ezekiel, the 47th chapter, and we'll focus on verses 1 and 2, 7 through 9, and 11 through 12. Verse 1, "Then he brought me back to the door of the house, and behold, water was flowing from under the threshold of the house toward the east, for the house faced east, and the water was flowing down from under, from the right side of the house, from the south of the altar. And he brought me out of the way of the north gate, and led me around on the outside to the outer gate, by way of the gate that faces east. And behold, water was trickling from the south side." Now let's skip down to verse 7. "Now when I had returned, behold, on the bank of the river, there were very many trees, on one side and on the other. And then he said to me, 'These waters go out toward the eastern region and go down into Arabah, and they go toward the sea, being made to flow into the sea. And the waters of the sea became fresh.' And it will come about," verse 9, "and it will come about that every living creature which swarms in every place where the river goes will live. And there will be very many fish, for these waters go there, and the others become fresh. So everything will live where the river goes." Verse 11. "But its swamps and marshes will not be made fresh. They will be left for salt. And on the river, and by the river, on its bank, on one side and on the other, will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, and their fruit will not fail. They will bear every month, because their water flows from the sanctuary, and their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing." Not unlike the passage we read earlier in Revelation. The clear implication is that before this flow, everything was not living, but dead or dying. This being the same for the river of life as in the Revelation 22 passage we find here in verse 9. A beautiful fit with the picture as establishment of the kingdom will open up the highway of holiness, a path for those who want to live, as opposed to their former path on the broad road that leads to destruction. Let's take a closer look at the detail in the passage. Verse 1, "The house is the temple of God, the glorified head and body, the Christ, the New Jerusalem. All of God's buildings, relating to the spiritual interests, have their entrance on the east. Those in harmony with his will walk in his buildings and thus walk contrary to the direction of the earth, as the earth turns on its axis from west to east. To walk through God's buildings, you have to walk from east to west. Thus we have clear indication that this house is indeed God's house. The right-hand side of the house is from the perspective of one inside the house, facing the entrance, thus on the south side of it. immediately to the southeast of the Temple Mount is where the Temple Mount where Solomon's temple once stood is the Kindred Valley. This slide's a little washed out, but it's a topographical representation of that area of Jerusalem. Notice the Temple Mount here, where the temple is built, and notice the sloping down to this. Oh, by the way, this is north going this way, so this is east going this way. So if you were standing inside this building, on your right, which is to the south, the waters departed, kind of to the southeast. And notice how they would flow down the Kidron Valley, and it turns out that out this direction will lead through swales and canyons and gorges out to the Dead Sea. If the water coming from that temple then is bringing life, as stated in verse 9, that is a function of the freshening of the sea as this water then would run out to the Dead Sea. In verse 8, we can infer that the salts of the sea are not here picturing the same thing as the salt associated with the church being the salt of the earth. No, here, salt is more typical of what it does to the Dead Sea. Salt kills all life in this body of water. There are some fish that survive at the inlet from the Jordan River at the very north end of this body of water. However, should they either get swept a little bit to the south or venture more than a few tens of meters from the inlet, that high salt concentration in that body will kill them shortly. It is truly a dead sea, even though it is likely it was never called this until sometime in the second or third century after the birth of our Lord. Prior to that, it had been referred to in Scripture or even historical writings as the Eastern Sea, distinguishing it from the Mediterranean to the west, or the Salt Sea. The Araba, mentioned in verse 8 in this passage, just means desert plain, which would be the case between the exit from the Kindred Gorge and to the Dead Sea. In other words, the land will flatten out after coming out this gorge just before it drains into the Dead Sea. There is even indication in verse 11 of the second death for those not coming into heartfelt reliance and acceptance of the kingdom arrangement. They are the swamps and marshes that will not be recipients of the clean water and that will otherwise heal the masses. But verses 9 and 12 are indicators of the glorious blessing of the kingdom, the flourishing of life, formerly in the dying race of Adam. The Jordan River and the Dead Sea are a water system that lies at the northern end of what is called the Syrian-African Rift, or sometimes it's called the Great Rift Valley or the Jordan Rift Valley. Although this slide, I blew it up so it's a little bit fuzzy. But this valley starts down here in Central Africa, in Kenya. And it is a depression in the land that goes up this way along the Gulf here, and then up the Gulf of Aqaba, and then along this valley. This eventually becomes the Dead Sea right in this area, and then ending at the source of the Jordan River in northern what is now called Syria. Is it not keeping in his character and what we know of God from the Scriptures that he planned in the creation of the foundation of the earth for the very creative forces that would form such a unique feature just to allow an unusually salty inland sea adjacent to the promised land? God coded that into the creation of the earth because this was important. This was going to show a picture of the healing of the arrangements for the benefit of the world of mankind. But how did this salty sea, this Dead Sea, come into being? Even given this geographical layout, there are two theories on how those creative forces made the Dead Sea come into what it is today. The first maintains that many years ago, a major earthquake created this valley, especially the part bordering Israel on the east. The Dead Sea sank deep into the valley and was deprived of its natural outflow and exchange of water with the Mediterranean Sea. Today, the Dead Sea is the lowest point on the face of the earth, some 1,200 feet below sea level. This valley is at the junction of two tectonic plates, the Arabian and the African plate. The Arabian plate being, the African plate being in this area, and the Arabian plate being in this area. I actually think it kind of gets cut off at this ridge near Africa, but it's a small plate in here. Both generally are moving to the northeast, but the Arabian plate is moving faster to the northeast than the African plate is, and it's moving farther to the east as it moves northward than the African plate. So the net effect of this is this valley or rift is actually getting wider. It's measured in terms of inches per year or per decade, but it is getting wider. The second theory is that plate movements and lava relatively near the surface of the valley and not a massive earthquake caused the land from the west of the valley to rise nearly 400 feet. Notice the elevations here. There's this kind of mountainous area that runs through Israel on the eastern side, and it kind of divides the land. To the west, it slopes down to the Mediterranean. To the east, it slopes down to the Dead Sea. But this area right here lies nearly 400 feet above the Dead Sea. This event also caused the land beneath the plate boundary to descend, forming this rift valley. And this is the northern edge of that rift valley we saw. And it kind of comes up to the mountains right here, and that's kind of the end of it. And it goes all the way down to Central Africa. You can follow this valley. You have to walk underwater in one of the gulfs, but you could still see the valley. Thus, this is why now the Dead Sea is cut off from any exchange of water from the Mediterranean, even though at one time it was felt they were at about the same elevation. So now this body of water must accumulate everything that the Jordan River sends down to it. The salt in this body of water is more than just what we would refer to as table salt. Table salt, as you know from your chemistry days in high school, is called sodium chloride. As the sodium variety in the water is only about half as much as another salt, calcium chloride, in the Dead Sea. Matter of fact, the salt that is twice as great as sodium chloride is magnesium chloride. And then there's a third salt that's only about half as much as the sodium chloride, and that is calcium chloride. Matter of fact, the total saltiness of the Dead Sea is some 5 to even 10 times greater than the saltiness of the oceans, because it depends on what time of year and at what depth you measure the saltiness of the Dead Sea. There's actually layers of water, even though it's all water, because of the temperature differential, there are actually layers where it's saltier than some of the higher layers. The salt content at the very bottom of the Dead Sea is what's called saturated. It can't contain any more solid material. If you add solid material to that, it has to come settle right out to the bottom. It won't stay in solution. So why is it so salty? And in general, what makes the oceans salty anyway? The natural process that contributes salt to the oceans is the fact that even before man began manufacturing and putting anything into the atmosphere that would cause the rain to change, rain as it falls is just slightly acidic. This makes lakes and rivers runoff traveling from higher elevations and working its way down to the ocean, whether it goes through rivers or whether even it goes into the ground and is carried from aquifers and then comes out in a spring somewhere else. That process, as the water flows, it is actually always dissolving the material it's up against. And that process creates salts that get dissolved into the water. It works its way back down to the levels of the ocean. Those salts in the ocean have to remain as the evaporation process takes only pure water back up into the clouds. And then in that process, it actually becomes slightly acidic again, falls back to the earth, and the process starts all over again. So the net effect is it is dissolving part of the earth in this cycle and depositing those things that it dissolves, mainly salts, back into the oceans. Additionally, as well, all the dead ocean marine life decays and decomposes, and those contribute to the salts that are dissolved in the ocean into solution. Even the seawater itself slowly dissolves rocks on the seafloor, adding to the salts in the ocean. And another source of it is that at the floors of most of the oceans, there are underwater volcanoes. We never see them because they erupt in the water. As soon as the volcano erupts, the lava is immediately cooled down and forms other rock. But in that process, it vents salts along with those lava flows, and those stay then in solution in the water. But what contributes to the incredible saltiness of the Dead Sea is its small size, its lack of outlet, and its low elevation. At 31 degrees north, it is roughly the same latitude as the city of New Orleans and the Gulf and our Gulf Coast. Thus, the conditions make it clearly either a tropical or semi-tropical climate. Prodigious evaporation goes on along with such conditions and such a climate, even if it was near sea level. Now take that same location, drop it 1,200 feet, the temperatures increase. I don't know if many of you have traveled to the Grand Canyon. The temperature at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, open, arid, but yet it's sometimes 10 to 15 degrees warmer at the bottom of the canyon than it is at the rim. And thus the Dead Sea, being another 400 feet below the surrounding mountains, has much higher temperatures down at the floor of that basin than there would be at the top of the mountains adjacent to it. So it takes all the water poured into it by the Jordan, and yet the water level doesn't go up. In fact, it is dropping consistently. So what we see is that the Dead Sea then has to absorb all those salts, all that material that is washed down here, and it's got nowhere to go. The water evaporates out, again, at a high rate, and leaves even more salt there. There's another reason, though, why the Dead Sea has so much salt in it. It just doesn't get as much water as it used to. Due to irrigation and other demands for fresh water above it, along the Jordan River and even at the Sea of Galilee, people are diverting water. They're diverting it for drinking water. They're diverting it for irrigation. And thus, the amount of water that actually gets into the Jordan is on the order of 2 to 5% of what used to flow into the Dead Sea years ago, before these developments started along the Jordan River above it. Even this fits with the picture. As time goes on, the life-killing properties of this sea, that being the relative salt content, get greater and greater. So does man's propensity for sin as time goes on. It gets greater and greater. We've seen that in our day. And so that even fits the general picture. The increasing salinity and decreasing level of the Jordan has many in both Israel and Jordan convinced that this is the sign of an impending ecological disaster. You know, I found that even in Brother Russell's day, this perceived deterioration was a concern. There was serious talk then of digging a canal from the Mediterranean eastward, anywhere along here, to provide a way of getting seawater into the Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is now clearly drying up. How do we know that? Take a look at some of these pictures. You can't see the lettering down here, but this aerial picture, this is the south end of the Dead Sea. It was taken in 1978. Look at how the sea looks. It was water all the way down to here, and this peninsula on the eastern side, looks kind of like a little rabbit's head, was clearly visible. This was taken in 2002. There is no literal water down here. These are pools that are used now for manufacturing and extracting some of the solids that are in the Dead Sea and some of the salts. But this peninsula has closed up this waterway, and this peninsula now is now the southern shore of the Dead Sea. Let's take a look at another one. Here you can see again this little bit of water that was here a few years ago is now totally gone. So this is the southern border of the Dead Sea, which was this peninsula, and this is just purely a manufacturing pool for extracting salts and other things that they're selling. You can kind of see it looking toward the east again here. Here is where the water is kind of cut off and where these pools begin down here. And looking at how that manufacturing process is a big industry, take a look at this. This is the southern end of this Dead Sea, south of where that peninsula was out here. And these are all divided into subpools, and there's huge industry going on at this point right here. It's dropping, the level in the Dead Sea is dropping almost a meter every year, 3 feet. Some have predicted that it will, for all practical purposes, disappear totally around the year 2050 if nothing is done and the status quo is maintained. Now, we mentioned that those old maps show that peninsula, and due to that drop in water level, that peninsula is now the southern shore. The drop in water level is mainly due to the diversion, again, as we mentioned, of the Jordan's water upstream for drinking and irrigation. Some have estimated that they would have to reduce the amount, again, 90-some percent of that water is being drawn out of the Jordan from the original flow. Some say you'd have to get that drain off down to the point where you're getting at least 30% of the original flow just to maintain the Dead Sea as it is today. The vision of replenishing the Dead Sea and making it more pleasant to be near, to function around, and even to use it recreationally, that vision lives on today, and it lives on without changing the current diversion of the Jordan's water supply. Even the old ideas of cutting a canal from the Mediterranean Sea have been recently reconsidered. Theodor Herzl, considered by some as the founder of modern Zionism, formulated the idea of a hydropower canal. In other words, they put a dam in it and extract power from it as well, connecting the Mediterranean Sea to the Dead Sea. He put it in a 1902 novel in Brother Russell's day called Altneuland. He wrote that it would be possible to take advantage of the 400-meter drop and to generate hydroelectric power. In the 1950s, the American conservationist Walter C. Loudermilk conducted research on a canal stretching from the Mediterranean across the Negev Desert to the Dead Sea. He calculated that, again, this 400-meter drop could generate 100 megawatts of electricity. That's about 10% of what a nuclear power plant can generate. Scientists have visited this idea of a hydroelectric scheme that would produce water without flooding and industrial sites along its shores. The countries bordering the region would like to freshen the water of the Dead Sea right now in our day with the revival of these ideas from the past. Currently, there is a project called the Dead Med or Dead Red Conduit or Water Conveyance. Dead Med refers to a conduit from the Mediterranean Sea to the Dead Sea, Dead Med, while the Dead Red designation refers to a canal from the Red Sea to the Dead Sea. Actually, even though this is the end of the Red Sea, this is called the Gulf of Aqaba, and the city of Aqaba is right here at the point of it, and then the canal that would be dug would go from here up to the Dead Sea. We'll get a little better picture of that on our next map. Here's the city of Aqaba, the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, the Dead Sea where the pipeline would terminate, and it would wind its way on both sides of Israel and Jordan as it worked its way northward. There's alternate routes here. There's designations of where there would be some other facilities, and we'll talk about those a little later. Here was an alternate route from just south of Gaza all the way over to the Dead Sea. Notice how much shorter it is. It's like half the distance. But there's already politics involved. They've rejected. This is only one of the three routes. Here are the other two up here. Look at how much shorter even these are to get from the Mediterranean Sea over to the Jordan and then let the water flow this way into the Dead Sea. But those other three routes across Israel have pretty much already been rejected. Israel had preferred this southernmost route from the Mediterranean to the Gaza Strip, but instead, it seems like the forces behind the scenes is set on a route, on the southern route, bringing water from the Gulf of Aqaba at the southernmost tip of Jordan, north, through the desert, again, along that Israeli-Jordan border to the southern end of the Dead Sea. You see that the other Dead Med routes would mean that the entire project would be under Israeli control, with Israel getting all the power, revenue, and there would also be likely fewer jobs for Arabs and payoffs in terms of profits to Arabs if any of those Western routes were considered. So it seems like the Dead Red route, that one to the south, is all that is under consideration now. This project actually got started under consideration in the 90s, and they recently had a meeting actually in the middle of June. So it seems to be moving along slowly. Although all the routes are mostly downhill, because again, the Dead Sea is 1,200 feet below the sea level here or the sea level here, there are some rises in between here and here, and so there will be some pumping needed along the way. Envisioned as another plus for the project is one or more hydroelectric dams to supply powers not only to do this pumping, but also to be built along the maybe resorts and other facilities here, and those hydroelectric dams would then provide the power for those facilities. Israel would also contribute its world-class desalinization technology to produce badly needed fresh water for the region. The salt removed from the drinking water would not be discarded. It would not be sold as salt, but it would be put back into the water that is ultimately discharged into the Dead Sea. Because remember, we told you how much more salty the Dead Sea is than the oceans are. So by adding the salt that you remove to make drinking water pure back into what you discharge into the Dead Sea, you've decreased this gap of this 5 to 10 times as salty this water is than this water is or that water. So by adding salt here that you took out of to make drinking water, you get a more salty discharge into the Dead Sea. It is not planned to be able to drop the salinity of the entire sea low enough to allow fish and other life to thrive to return, though. But in principle, a minor intimation of that prophecy in Revelation, nonetheless. It's an interesting concept that man is actually looking at doing what God said he will ultimately do as a blessing to the world of mankind. But this project is expected to take between 20 and 27 years and cost around $15 billion in today's money. Currently, it's looking like it will be financed by the World Bank, which probably means that it will be years until it is even started, thus making it more likely that God's kingdom will accomplish preservation of the Dead Sea rather than the world of mankind accomplishing that. So, even if mankind can't, or more likely fails in the ideas of the project of this age, we can't help but think there will still be both a literal and a spiritual fulfillment of these prophecies in restoring life to the Dead Sea. Maybe one of God's first projects for mankind will be doing just that. He'll utilize some of the technology that he brings from the old world into the kingdom arrangement to actually do this project. And notice, here's kind of an aerial view from space, but you can see here's the Gulf of Aqaba and the tip right there. And it has to rise a little bit, and then once it gets to this point, it's all downhill to the Dead Sea. So you'd build a pipe. Some of the routes were this way, some of the routes were this way. But this is that Great Rift Valley again. It comes up here from Africa and goes down the Gulf, and there it is. There is that valley that's formed literally that whole way. Maybe and after that's accomplished, we can't help but think it will no longer be referred to as the Dead Sea, but God will give it a new name to that sea, a new, more appropriate name, picturing man's return from sin and death to life everlasting. There's still another reference to this river of life in the kingdom, and that's found in Zechariah 14, the first 9 verses. Brother Russell uses the discussion of these verses in closing his considerations for the entire volume of Volume 4. So if you want to find his words on this, just read the last 4 or 5 pages of Volume 4. Zechariah 14:1. Behold, the day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half of the city exiled. But the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on the day of battle. And in that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives will be split in the middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half of the mountain will move toward the north and the other half toward the south. If you flee by the valley of my mountains, for the valley of the mountains will reach Azel, yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, the king of Judah. Then the Lord, my God, will come, and all the holy ones with him. And it will come about in the day that there will be no light. The luminaries will dwindle. For it will be a unique day, which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but will come about that at the evening time there will be light. And it will come about in that day that the living waters will flow out of Jerusalem, half of them toward the eastern sea and the other half toward the western sea. And it will be in summer as well as in winter. And the Lord will be king over all the earth. In that day, the Lord will be the only one, and his name, the only one. You know, it's similar to those other two passages we discussed, both in Ezekiel and Revelation. But let's just take a little time to go over some of the things that are just slightly different. In one of his earliest watchtowers, that's reprint 286 to be exact, Brother Russell felt that the evidences of the Jews returning to Israel that he had seen since the Lord's return met the expectation and the description of the spoil that is mentioned here in verse 1. That humble beginning was the return of the spoil to the Jews taken from them in the Roman destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. However, verse 2 was felt then, and I'm sure by most here now, putting the gathering of Gog and Magog and the plunderers still in the future. Don't we so look forward to that day when God will fight openly for his chosen people, spoken of in the next verse? Or in verse 3. When God's time shall have fully come, when the lease of power to the Gentiles shall have run out, when the sacrificing of the great atonement, the gospel age, shall have ceased, when the high priest shall have finished making atonement, not only for his own body, the church, but for his house and for all the people, and he shall come forth to bless the people, then Jehovah's curse or sentence of death shall be lifted from the earth. His footstool, tabernacle, will again be recognized, and its beautifying in righteousness and truth and in the Holy Spirit of love shall begin and progress until the end of the millennial age. All the willing and righteous shall have reached perfection or will be reunited with Jehovah, and all the unwilling will have been destroyed. Verse 4 makes an interesting picture even just to think about. God standing on the Mount of Olives, splitting it in two, forming a valley from west to east. Now certainly that's not really a literal fulfillment of what will happen. Brother Russell says in volume 4 that this signifies the two parts of the kingdom, distinctly separated according to a divine order or arrangement. The separation indicates no opposition between the two parts of the kingdom. It is, on the contrary, for the purpose of producing the valley of blessing in between, to which all who desire the divine aid may flee and find succor under the blessed protection of both the heavenly and the earthly phases of the kingdom. The day spoken of in verse 6 is not the day of judgment, which so many translators have tried to harmonize it with. The day is the earliest dawning of the millennial day, when restitution, though in full institution, and although it is in the Son of Righteousness, will arise and shine. It will scatter earth's long night of sin and superstition and death. It will nevertheless be only partially bright, because throughout its time it will be dealing with generation after generation of fallen race to be brought back from the tomb and in various stages of restitution toward perfection. But how refreshing is it to be assured that in the day of the reestablishment of Jehovah's feet upon his footstool, that there will be no more thick darkness, and that at the close of the millennial day, instead of growing darker, the world will have finally reached the brightest of its light of the knowledge of Jehovah, and that the sun of that day will never set. Then we read on in verses 8 and 9. The river of life, flowing not just out to the eastern sea, but to the western one as well. There will no longer be a winter of sin, so that it can be said that the river will flow henceforth forever. For the sake of mankind, don't we look forward to that day at the end of the millennial age when Jehovah is the king over all the earth? Then man will have no need for the mediation of Christ to be able to fully stand before God and live. It will be the completion and fruition of God's plan. What God desired from the beginning of all creation, a race of free moral agents capable of choosing between sin and life and having the experience with each, and overwhelmingly choosing life everlasting under his rule. Then it can be truly said, as in Numbers 14:21, Habakkuk 2:14, and as Isaiah 11:9 states, "They will not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea." And in Revelation 21:3-4, "And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men. He shall dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be among them. And he shall wipe away every tear from their eye. There shall no longer be any death. There shall no longer be any mourning, or crying, or pain, for those things have passed away.'"